people always ask me, like, I'm lost, how do I find my way? And I'm like, well, one, what is important to you? What are your values? And then what brings you joy? And I think innately, that's what I was doing as a kid until up to today. I was just doing things that brought me joy because I was in a place of unhappiness and all I was looking for was a feeling of happiness. And I always had interests of design and architecture, but did I know at that time I was going to pursue it? No.
This week's guest is Sarah A. Abdallah, polymath, innovator, and founder of New York-based Bespoke Architecture and Design Studio, Functional Creative Design. In this two-parter, we spend the first hour exploring Sarah's experience of being born a biracial child to Egyptian immigrant parents and growing up in New York with two younger siblings, immersing her in a culture that nurtured her natural curiosity. Her parents instilled in her the foundational values of human kindness, the importance of education, and a respect and understanding of other faiths. Sarah discusses how she developed an appreciation and love for the environment, her deep spirituality, questioning conventional wisdom, and rejecting her parents' pressure to conform. She recounts overcoming the limitations of dyslexia and her childhood curiosity of after-school clubs that helped shape her into the thought leader and entrepreneur she is today, and her prolific educational journey through psychology, art therapy, higher education, and interior design. Sarah also discusses how serendipity led her at 21, a first-generation Muslim Egyptian-American, to live with the then 70-year-old iconic lawyer, Jewish civil rights activist, and philanthropic fundraiser for New York University, Naomi Levine. In part two, we dive deep into Sarah's journey prior to starting her design studio, Functional Creative Design, working with Rockwell Group, Tony Chin Associates, Perkins and Eastman, and Grand Hotels, and her vision and focus, which led her to starting her own studio. For anyone with children, hearing Sarah's journey and experience will provide valuable insights into encouraging young children's curiosity and appreciation for other cultures and backgrounds and the values of education. Now, on with the show. Welcome to the Impossible Network podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited.
It's super exciting to be sitting in a room at Neuhaus doing a face-to-face interview again.
I know, finally, that we're getting together in person.
I mean, you could be fooled into thinking that we're returning to normality, but that isn't happening.
No, I think we're it's all about the new normal. I think there is no way to getting back to where we were before, even though sometimes I fall asleep and wake up and I'm like, is it 2019? Yeah, but hey, we're just going to have to establish how to be again with other humans and establish more intimacy and a physical format that's more comfortable.
Well, I'm sure we're going to come and talk about that in a bit more detail. First of all, I want to give a shout out to Rodney Durso, a previous guest that recommended that we interview you. And obviously we should acknowledge that we're both co-members of Neuhaus, the community here in New York, but it was Rodney Durso that recommended. So I think it's a great idea. So we're going to come and talk about your life in your business around functional creative design, and we'll certainly ask you to define that that term and what it means, and discuss the work you're doing just now and how it's impacting the future of work and the future of the spaces we occupy. But before we do, can you talk a bit about your childhood and your education? From what I understand, you were born to Egyptian immigrants and who'd moved here to the US, and you have two siblings. But beyond that, I don't really know much else from what I've some of the research I've done.
Maybe
you could give us a little bit more detail about your upbringing.
Yeah, born here right in Manhattan in New York City. My father at the time was working for NYU/Bellevue. It was the same hospital. And so he was working there. And so that's why I was born there, actually. I always asked, why was I born in the city? Grew up in the tri-state area, 30 minutes out of the city. Actually, it's closer. It's like my dad said, door to door from where he had to go to, you know, to the hospital. It was 10 minutes because he would commute and do the night shift. And he was a certified clinical laboratory technician, and then moved up and was in charge of the laboratory. So chemistry bachelor's degree mm-hmm. in chemistry. My mother is an accountant, worked for the MTA in the corporate offices down in Wall Street. And she was there the entire time. So both worked for the city of New York. Mm-hmm.
What brought them to the U.S.?
Oh, yeah. So my father came actually alone, and he said with $200-$300 in his pocket in the early 70s. And he shared an apartment in the city with like four other Egyptian, you know, guys.
So he was qualified at that point.
He was qualified at that point. But, you know, in the 70s, mm-hmm. how do you prove coming from another country, your certifications? Yeah. There was really difficult, right? So he started like from the ground up, like working. You know, even though he had a BA, he was doing, you know, just different jobs, mm-hmm. you know, just to kind of get by wow. until he met somebody in his industry who then introduced him to someone at the hospital that then got him in an interview. Mm-hmm. And it's really incredible because at that time, it was all about who you knew. And I think it's still the case, right?
I was about to say, yeah. What's changed?
Yeah. And my mother, so my dad went back after he saved enough money to go see his family. And he was like, I want to get married. Mm-hmm. At the time, I think Egypt was a different place than it was today. It was really open. I asked my mother the story and I would say, hey, how did you and Baba like meet? And she was like, well, we had what you call a speed dating event at the mosque. And she sat in a room and one man at a time would come through and it was kind of like a lineup. And she would say, number one, two, and three. And one of them was my father. And then they got like a personal, like one-on-one conversation. And I guess my father won.
Wow.
The speed dating.
There's a TV show now.
At the mosque.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, that's how they met. They dated briefly, like chaperone dates. Mm-hmm. And then my father came back to the U.S. to do some work and then went back. He bought my mom's wedding dress here in New York City and then took it back. And they had the wedding there in Cairo. Mm-hmm. And then I actually was just going through old photos with my father this past weekend where he was showing me photos at JFK. I think they flew TWA.
A. Yeah.
Yeah. And they got her dressed up in her wedding dress. Like at arrival, there was a photo at JFK of my mom coming out of the airline mm-hmm. and my father dressed in a suit with a red bow tie. It was so cute. Wow. And they had a reception at a hotel nearby the hotel to kind of greet my mom to the U.S.
Wow, amazing.
Yeah, so she was 11 years younger than my father. And and my dad, so I guess my mom was 19 at the time, almost 20. Mm-hmm. She had started her, she was in college at the time. But so she had to finish college here in the States. She was studying, she loved English, like English literature was her major. And at the time there was like no real, like my father's like, all teachers are like losing their jobs right mm-hmm. now. Like you should switch, you know, your major. And he's like, I think you should do accounting. And my mom's like, I hate numbers and I hate math. Like, but he pushed her, she went into accounting only because, you know, it was more secure, like, industry, like, mm-hmm. in the mid-70s. So, like, my dad, as I just recently asked, when was the wedding? And he said, April 1975 is when they got married. And shortly after, she, you know, flew alone on TWA to come to JFK, where my dad greeted her.
Interesting time to come to New York.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was such a bustling.
Isn't it around the time when it was going through a financial crisis?
And, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. A lot of upheaval and then also a lot of culture happening.
Yeah,
yeah, it was really gritty. Uh-huh. But they got a small apartment in Jersey City, which is 10 minutes from downtown Manhattan. And a lot of Muslim Egyptians uh-huh. were immigrating around that same time. So it was like everybody was talking to each other. It's either you go live in, you know, Brooklyn, uh-huh. in Bay Ridge or in Jersey City.
Yeah. It's funny.
But it's all word of mouth, right? It's like if you have other people from your culture, community, that, you know, it's like, oh, where should we go? they then...
I know. You need to have that community around you.
That's
to
right.
To maintain the,
that's
sort
right.
of the culture.
Yeah. And yeah, so my parents immigrated here, not just alone, like around the same time there were other young couples, you know, like moving from Egypt to here, also because there was a lot of upheaval in Cairo, right, politically. And I think it was the time of Nasser.
No, it was after Nasser, wouldn't
it? Was
it have been
after
Anwar
Nasser.
Sadat?
Oh, Anwar Sadat. Yeah. And yeah, so he was like, I asked my father all the time, why did you like leave and come here? Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I wanted the American dream, like the opportunity to, you know, do more, you know, with our education. You know, a lot of people are educated and weren't able to get well-paid jobs. And, you know, sometimes that's still the case, unfortunately, you know, and people have to leave to other countries to find other ways to continue to grow.
So what about their combined influence on you, and your personality and your worldview and your values?
Yeah. So I think between arriving here, getting married, you know, in the mid-70s, like landing in Jersey City and starting like their life together as the family grew after, you know, past me. I think we were living in a small one-bedroom apartment that was really cramped. And I think I remember one time visiting one of my parents' friends, and they had a house and a backyard. And I was like, I looked at my dad and I'm like, I want a backyard. I want more room, you know. And he just looked at me, and, you know, I think that kind of stemmed like a long thinking process on his end, because months after, shortly after, basically, him and my mom started looking at apartments, you know, especially because they were expecting my brother. And, you know, it's just like two kids and, you know, two adults and then a third child on the way. You need more room. And so they landed in Bergen County in a really quaint, small town that really historical town that basically I grew up in, and, you know, I would sneak back into the city when I was 15 with my friend, who her mom was a single mom, and I used to stay with them. I used to sneak in and go all to the nightclubs at night. My parents don't know this, so like when they listen to this, they're gonna be like, "What did she do?" and you know, went to the hottest spots in the city that people used to talk about, the Lamplight, the Palladium, the Tunnel, you know.
And they had no idea.
No, they had no idea. They had no idea, but I was lucky, you know. And back then, you just popped a token in the subway.
Wow.
And the subway was not safe.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah. 15, 16 years old.
Yeah, well, we took the path and we were pretty much on foot. Once in a while, we'd get on the subway to get to the next location, but typically we'd walk, you know, all to like the downtown locations of all the nightclubs.
Wow. That's very cool.
Yeah. But I think you were asking me like,
what the values in your worldview. I mean, a lot of immigrant children are very driven by their parents because, as you said, dad came with $300 in his pocket, wanting success, the American dream. And I think it is fair to say that a lot of immigrants, families push their children in certain directions, law, medicine being two prime examples.
Yeah.
And just wondered if that pressure, not pressure, but encouragement to exceed expectations was placed on you, that you felt an expectation of your parents.
I think I have to start, as a young child, I was really interested in a lot of things. And because they didn't have a support system, like aunts and uncles around to like help them with the kids. Like my parents fought a lot, and it was like at times a really difficult like space to be in, hearing them argue and fight. And I was looking for an outlet to not to be home to hear that. And so when I was in middle school and high school, I looked for opportunities to stay in school longer. I didn't want to go home. So I joined the poetry club. I joined the acting club. Like literally every single evening there was an after school activity or club, I joined it. Mm-hmm. And I love poetry and I was so excited to learn more about poetry. I was excited about acting because I would watch my father and mother, and like when we were kids we would watch these things called masrahayat. Masrahayat are like these theater, like comedy theater that was like filmed back anywhere between the 40s, 50s, 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. That's why Egypt is so well known for its the arts. Yeah. Right. And so I was like, I want to learn how to act, you know, and I joined the art club. And so I would paint, and I used to draw, paint and sculpt starting at the age of 6. And the same art teacher that I had in elementary school was in high school. And so she really encouraged me and pushed me to like actually pursue a BFA. It's just, it's amazing how many people influenced my like growth. But I think I was just an the reason I wanted to be outside of the house really made me like then pursue my own interests, right? My parents didn't encourage me to do any of that. They were so busy both working, commuting back and forth between New York City and the suburbs with three children, with no help, you know? And so I remember one distinct day, because my dad said, I don't care where you are, you better be at the dinner table at 5 p.m. because he really wanted to spend that 1 hour with us or 2 hours that he had catching up with us and see us, because he was working a day shift and a night shift. He was working two shifts. And he looked at me and he said, Sara, where do you go right after school? Because why are you rushing? Like, I see you like sometimes like rushing in the door while I'm pulling into like the driveway. And I was like, oh, I'm in the poetry club Mondays, Tuesdays, it's art class, you know, Wednesdays is, I forget what else I did, you know, Thursdays was definitely a night that I was doing a theater club. And then shortly after I joined the track and field and cross country, and I was an athlete. I was actually one of the best athletes in high school, college, and grad school. Like, it was part of, like, that shaped who I was. And it was, like, sort of what I call today my moving meditation, or, you know, and it was, like, sort of therapy, because I didn't really have anyone to talk to about what was happening at home. I was sometimes getting close to some of my teachers, like my art teacher or my typing teacher at the time. Learn how to type on a typewriter. And I was born.
I wish it had happened when I was going to school. It happened for girls that were doing sort of typing, but guys didn't do it. And I look back and regret.
Oh, funny. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
There were girls and guys in my class. I mean,
not my school, not in Scotland.
Not Scotland. No.
There's quite sort of clear delineation between what the boys and girls did.
Yeah. I think it's because the time period I was born and raised in, I had one foot into technology and one foot out. Mm. And so my sister and my brother are millennials, but like for me, I feel like I am, but part of me is not, you know,
because there is a term one of our guests called, I think it was Michael Ventura, who runs an agency in the West Village called Sub Rosa,
uh-huh.
Written a book called Applied Empathy. It's very good.
Okay.
He said he sits in between that Gen Z and millennial generation.
That's
and
right.
He had a name for it. I wish I could remember. But he said that there is a four-year crossover period where you don't really fall into the characteristics of either.
That's right.
And that's probably you.
Me, yeah. And so I can relate to both, right? But I never felt like I was part of either, you know? But I think both of my parents, they grew up in a secular household back in Egypt. So not really with any religion, even though they grew up Muslim. They both found religion a little, like, got more practicing, like, as they got a little bit older.
Mm-hmm.
I think my mom did right before she came and married my father. Her sister was in the hospital, and some woman was preaching about God and told her, you know, And then that's when my mom started becoming, wore the hijab, yeah, the mm-hmm. headscarf. And my dad, you know, again, he didn't really grow up with really religion at the time. Egypt was so open mm-hmm. and secular because yeah. there was the French influence, the British influence, and all these other things happening culturally.
Muslim Brotherhood were suppressed.
They were, yeah, they were really not yeah. part of that time period. And so I think my dad encouraged culture. Like every Sunday morning, he wanted all us kids to get up and not sleep in. So he would play, you know, some like famous Egyptian song and be like drumming on some pot. Wake up, you know. And he would be like, umu, umu means get up, you know. It was so fun. And we were like, Dad, it's so loud, stop. And my mom was really, that taught us about being good and God and, you know, and they encouraged us. Education was a big part of like what they taught us, like to get ahead. We need to get educated. We have to go, you know, get our college degrees. But I was the first in my family to get a master's. And I think they didn't anticipate that. You know, they were like, I was just on a trajectory, like leadership, business, giving back to the community. I literally did all those things at the age of 8 and upward. And my parents were, I went to Catholic school when I was a kid, being Muslim at a Catholic
school. That's unusual.
Yeah, it's very unusual.
Was that through choice?
Yes.
Or districting?
Yeah. No. My parents wanted, they thought public at the time, we were in Jersey City. They didn't think that there was a good, safe public school, so they put us in Catholic school. So every Wednesday, I would go to church and read about the Bible. But my mom thought it was a good idea because she's like, even though you're Muslim, he's like, you know, Muslims need to know and learn the Bible and mm-hmm. the Torah, the Old Testament. Yeah. And so, like, she encouraged us to learn. And then every Sunday, I had different friends from different backgrounds. I would go to Protestant church or Lutheran church or a Catholic church. And I was like, oh, you know, Dana invited me to go to her Lutheran church. Oh, of course, go. Mm-hmm. And she was excited that I was interested in God and learning different, you know, versions of it. But she would always remind me, don't forget, you're Muslim. But by the time I was 8, I was learning about Buddhism. And by the time I was 10, I was like, what is all this organized religion? What's the difference? And when I was growing up, I thought there was only one there was only one type of Muslim. I didn't know that there was other sects, yeah. right? And I just would just sit at home in my room and think, why? And there, I thought, you know, Africans were Africans and Arabs were Arabs, but no, there was different countries. And I kept thinking, well, why are we so broken down into like subjects and I guess, you know, it's really people want to put a name towards something. And as a young child, I was confused. It's almost like I was born into an era or time period, and I was like, why does everyone have labels for everything? And I was a very young, confused child, you know, but it was so interesting because I was just continually reading, and I would ask for new books to read. And I think that's why I'm a spiritual person now, you know, and it took a long journey of 40 years to get there, right? And because of it, I was looked at as the black sheep of my family. You know, like I would always push every single boundary. I would ask questions. I was very inquisitive. Like my parents are like, why? I would say, well, why do you believe this? She's like, because that is the way it is. Like, and I'm like, well, that's not good enough. Even though I did practice it. I practice in Muslim. I even helped go like put together like a Muslim camp, and I was I had a leadership role in it, but I didn't drink all the Kool-Aid, you know, as one would say. I did it to go through it, to learn, to understand. I wanted to understand where everybody, what was everybody feeling? What did they, how are they connecting? But that was the same thing when I went to the Lutheran church or the Catholic church or the Protestant church. For me, it was a time of observing and learning.
Because from everything I've read about you, the word polymath sprung to mind.
Yeah.
And the way you describe yourself there as being I mean, obviously, very curious child, mm-hmm. Questioning, almost bordering on nonconformity.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Challenging authority. Where do you think that came from? Do you think it was innate, or was it something that your parents encouraged?
I definitely don't think they encouraged it. Mm. I think they at times they would get frustrated. You know, I just was a curious child, and I think it was literally innate in me, like, not to conform. Mm. I don't know if it was like an ancestral thing that was coming through saying don't conform, because there was so much conformity in the past. Mm-hmm. But something inside me always told me no. Like, mm-hmm. I was like, well, I want to do it differently. And I just was, it was almost like, you know, two sides of a magnet, and you felt pulled towards the other side to do something different.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only way I can really describe it, that feeling.
Is that, because one of the questions I wanted to ask you is, were any defining moments of your childhood that set you on the path that you've taken? Was it that feeling of those polar extremes and that pull, or was there any other influence?
Particularly in my childhood, I think, again, it was the volatile, like, situation at home continued to grow, and things got, it wasn't an easy childhood. And I love my parents, and they're really a great people, but I think, you know, sometimes two people don't belong together, right? And there was at times a lot of different types of what we call abuse, right? Mm. Verbal, physical, emotional. And I was at the age of 15, 16, I was suicidal. And I would journal a lot in my room. And I was going through a lot as a young child. I wasn't just... At the age of 6, I was diagnosed with, legally diagnosed with a learning disability, dyslexia, and I never really talk about it, because I remember sitting at the counselor's office and had asked her, I really want to get retested, because at the time they had me in a separate room taking English and like math, and I was like, I want to get reintegrated into, like, I want to take AP English. Mm. And she looked at me, she's like, you have a permanent disability, it's probably almost impossible that you'll get into AP English, and you should probably think, you know, you're most likely you're not even going to get a college degree. That's how bad my dyslexia was.
That could also damage someone's self-perception and self-belief at that a young age, to be told that.
Oh, so
in terms of self-fulfilling beliefs.
Of course. And I looked at her and I said, I demand to be tested. I had to be the one who, like, my parents were too busy doing their thing. And I looked at her, I was like, I know for sure that I am allowed a test. And I don't know what inside of me at the age of 15, like, pushing her to do this, but I did. I took the test, I passed, and I was put in AP English. The same woman who told me that I would never get college
degree. People outside the US, describe what AP English is?
It's like an advanced English class, basically.
Okay.
That would get recognized when you go to college.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a curriculum that you typically don't take in high school level. It's like it's considered a college level class.
I mean, I suffer from, I wouldn't say learning issues, but I fractured my skull when I was 7 and I had a personality change. And it led me to having from having very good attention to having no attention because of the fractured skull and the concussion that I suffered. And ever since that point onward, I had some form of mild dyslexia, particularly reading things. My reading speed went down, and my ability to see even a headline in a newspaper, I would read something completely different. So when you describe your voracious appetite for books, that's surprising as well for someone that's been diagnosed as dyslexic. It is hard. Speaking from my own sort of perspective, I still find it hard to read at speed.
Yeah, so exactly. It takes me longer than an average person to read. But I also was writing backwards and upside down. It was like, I have an old journal from when I was 6 years old. And literally, you cannot read it. It's literally every single letter is like literally reversed and upside down. So my brain, and to me, that looked normal, you know? And I had such great teachers that worked with me, and it was caught so early that a lot of that was corrected. Mm-hmm. But you will see it in my grammar and my spelling. I always have to have someone proofread my stuff because there is no way that I can correct it.
It's the benefit of Grammarly. It's a big,
bonus
in my life.
Right?
Grammarly's premium.
But when, you know, it's interesting, like it's always affected me, what my reading speed. And the problem with that is like some exams in the industry as a designer and architect, when I had to get my lead AP certification, when it first came out, I had to learn not just the interior design portion of it. It was structural engineer and how to rectify like a land that might be chemically, it needed to be chemically cleaned up. And so I literally had to study every single section. Now the exam is broken up to your specific niche in the industry. And I had to take the exam 3 times. And every single time it was because I was rushing through and it's a timed exam and I would miss it by 1 point and because I was rushing through it. And finally, I decided to reach out to my college administrator, who was my disability coach, and had to get a letter from her and get a letter from the doctor. And, you know, she wrote a really great letter and said, you know, not many students, you know, many kids are diagnosed under the 504, you know, ADA Act. This is a permanent disability. And so with that letter, I was able to get an extension to take the exam on time the 3rd time. And then I passed the lead AP exam, but it was really important to have that certification. And that was 20 years ago. You know, it was like when it first literally came out, I've always believed in the, being an advocate for the environment. Like the earth was always important. And I don't know if it was because my father loved to like have a little garden. Every summer we would plant seeds in the backyard and we would grow cucumbers and tomatoes and just a slew of mint, like for mint tea, monacheya, which is like seeds that you probably shouldn't have here, but it's from Egypt. It's like a green soup, basically.
You're beginning me to edit that out.
Yeah. I mean, he doesn't do that anymore, but you know, yeah. But back in the day, it was kind of funny. But I think I have had a love for building and mm-hmm. for earth, because I think my dad had a knack of an interest in antiques. Mm-hmm. We would always go to like, what are they called? Garage sales and moving sales and estate sales. Mm-hmm. And look for little finds. And he would tell me like, oh, this is a unique piece from this century. And he'd like, look at these details. I built physically our backyard deck, like patio with my father at the age of 8, like mixing cement and stuff, you know. And it was like, for my dad, I think it was like free labor. And for me, I was learning.
Vocational training.
Yeah, and I was the eldest. But I think my mom used to yell at my father, stop, make her do things outside, you know. Mm. I mean, it was just like mid-80s, late 90s. Uh-huh. And I was literally mowing the lawn and doing all these activities outside, you know, like mm-hmm. if I was a boy, you know, back in the day, you know, those things were like gender assigned, right? And, she would say, she's not going to know how to cook for her husband. And I was like, Mom, don't worry. I watch you. I'm like, I'm a visual person. She didn't really understand that I learned visually, right? And so I would see her like cutting, you know, the tomatoes and the onions and, you know, making her like North African stew dish. And I literally knew how to make it just by like running in the kitchen for a few minutes, watching her and running out. And I think there was an incident probably like 15 years ago. She was ill. And she was about to cancel Thanksgiving dinner. And I was like, don't cancel it. I'll cook. And she was like, you cook? She did not believe I could cook a Thanksgiving dinner. I did everything from the turkey to like making butternut nut squash soup from scratch. And then she said, well, let me like make some traditional dishes just in case like everything else doesn't come out. But they talked about that dinner for many, many years later. Like they could not believe it. Mm-hmm. But because I left the house at the age of 17 mm-hmm. to go to college, and end up learning that you could take a student loan. I didn't have any money to pay for living on campus, and I needed to get out of that environment because it was, and I think that was a catalyst. Mm-hmm. Like it was me being depressed and wanting to move out of that environment that kind of pushed me mm-hmm. to the next level.
Because let's go back, because you said that you felt suicidal age 16. Was it the environment of the arguing and the abuse that you were witnessing?
I think it was a combination. It was definitely, that was a part of it. But mm-hmm. I think also being confined to what their thought process on culture and community and what, like, how I was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
I was, because the way I thought never really fit in the box,
mm-hmm.
they kept pushing me to, like, be a certain way. Like, I was...
And that nonconformity in you was rebelling.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was, I remember what I did. I wrote a letter, a 5-page letter to my parents after I found out my loan was approved and that I was able to get housing on campus. I like wrote this letter, packed my bag, and I was going to have my friend Marcella, who had helped me get this loan, to come and pick me up in her car and drive me to school. Well, My dad found that letter and my suitcase, and he said, I need to talk to you about something I found. And anytime we have a conversation in the living room, you know it's serious. I'm like, oh, here we go. So we sat down, and he was like, what is this? And I was like, well, go ahead and read it. It's for you, you know? So he opens this letter, and he quietly reads it. And I remember distinctly his face looking up at me, and he knew at that time, and I don't remember exactly what I wrote, but that he couldn't say no.
Mm-hmm.
I clearly indicated that I was unhappy and that this is the only way, you know? And so he said, okay, with stipulation that you come home every weekend and that you get a beeper. So he could mm-hmm. page me if he needed me. This was before cell phones, right? And so I said, sure, no problem. So we agreed. We came to an agreement, and that's what I did. Every weekend I would come, spend the weekend with my family. They even, you know, took the time to drive me to campus and move me
into
my dorm.
And this was your degree in psychology?
So, yeah. So I have a double major, a BFA in fine arts, and and a BA in psych. I also have gender studies as a minor and art therapy as a second minor. And all these things were so interesting to me to study. But I just wanted to major in fine arts. And he's like, you're not going to get a job in it. You're going to be a poor artist in the streets of New York City. No way am I going to pay for your education. And you are going to just have a BFA.
What was your plan at school? Did you have an ambition and any sense of the direction you were going to go, and you ending up with your focus on functional design? I mean, that again is an indication of your eclectic interests in many subjects and your sort of polymath type character.
Yeah.
That you, or was it through design that you selected each of these?
No, it was actually.
Or was it just a rampant curiosity to learn?
I mean, I was drawing and sketching since I was 6 years old. I always loved the arts. I love food and cooking. I had a lot of interests. I even played the piano and played the flute, you know. And I think for me, it was exploring the world and exploring what brought me joy was how I kind of ended up where I am today, right? I think people always ask me, like, I'm lost. How do I find my way? And I'm like, well, one, what is important to you? Where are your values? And then what brings you joy? And I think innately, that's what I was doing as a kid until up to today. I was just doing things that brought me joy. because I was in a place of unhappiness and all I was looking for was a feeling of happiness. And I always had interests of design and architecture, but did I know at that time I was going to pursue it? No. I mean, because I was so psychologically influenced and by the situation at home, actually, I started studying social psychology and I was going to be a social worker. I attended a lot of a prep class, and they had three people who were in the field come and talk to students. And after all the stories I heard, I was like, I could definitely not do this. I'm extremely sensitive. I can feel other people's feelings. I would be like a miserable person. So I quickly decided that psychology would be my second major because my dad, it was like our compromise. Find something else to study. You could double major. He wanted to make sure I was secure in a job. You know, he didn't come all the way here to leave his entire family behind so I could have, you know, a fluffy job that I may or may not, you know, be able to.
Gave you joy, but no, yeah, it didn't exactly take you anywhere.
Yeah. He's like, I want to make sure you're going to be able to pay your bills and mm-hmm. live a good life, right? And so I understood that. I heard it. And I wanted to honor everything they did too, right? Like they left everything behind to give us a better life. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's part of me struggled with like wanting to give myself joy and also respecting their journey as well. And that was my happy medium, mm-hmm. studying psychology and fine arts. Psychology was really important to me because early childhood development is so, it's so crucial. People do not understand how crucial it is. I think a child's brain is really open. It's like a sponge. Mm-hmm. It could really soak up multiple languages. Just because children can't speak doesn't mean they're not absorbing and taking an energy and understanding of the world. And I think because of the situation between my mother and father, it definitely impacted me. And not in a good way, you know? And I think I had to work backwards. I had to reprogram my brain and work through lots of therapy to like get through a better place. And besides therapy, the healing arts, you know, Reiki and energy healing and all sorts of things. So
it is interesting that the lack of appreciation until recent decades about the impact on the neuroplasticity of children from an early age. I mean, it's interesting you talked about that age 8, which is the time when children reach that point of, let's say, maturity mm-hmm. in terms of their mental maturity, where radical sort of change can't happen at the same way pace it has done up to those critical first 8 years.
That's right.
We interviewed Kelly Lauf, runs an organization called MindSpark a couple mm-hmm. of weeks ago, and mm-hmm. she's doing amazing work with STEM, really working from deliberately working from K through 8 as the key ages to really get children and to sort of accelerate their creativity and to spark it and to allow them to sort of pursue their natural areas of interest. And I think there is she talks about the fact that her mission is to re-engineer education. And I think it's very interesting when you start to see people like her emerge, and it gives you hope for what the future of humanity might be like. And we move towards a machine learning AI driven world.
Yeah, I think it's really important. It's really, really crucial that we kind of, I think education is at the core of all our issues, really, to be honest. Like, you know, the race issues that we're currently having, the environmental issues, like it's all about educating the youth and really, really early on everything, you know?
Yeah. Let's not talk about the pandemic.
Oh, and the pandemic. Oh, Jesus.
Well, okay. So you said you did your psychology, double psychology and fine arts. You've got a MA in higher ed. And your interior design degree from Parsons, but if also you went to FIT, Fashion Institute of Technology, mm-hmm. and Advanced Arabic Studies in Beirut. I mean, this is quite an eclectic educational journey. Where has serendipity played its part in your journey?
Yeah, it's funny. So because I was super active on campus as an undergraduate, I was always hanging out with the deans of the school and trying to find ways to give back. I'm always, for me, giving back was, brings me a lot of joy. And long story short, I was really close to one of the deans because I was working. There was a grant given to the college, because I went to a small college called Ramo College in Mahwah, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And they, it was a grant to educate students that they can have fun without drugs and alcohol. And so with the dean's permission, I was sitting on this, and I said, let's create these incredible concerts where people are having fun, and there's music, and there's alternative, there's no alcohol, and there's just like cool drinks that are non-alcoholic. And so we would do this. So we did it, and we filmed it, and like the government was like, how incredible, you know? And so like the grant kept coming. So I established really good relationships with the deans, and this particular dean had graduated from Columbia Law School, and he said, do you know what your next steps are in your education? And I said, I have no idea. I guess I'll just get a job in psychology. Mm-hmm. Like, and he said, well, you know, what about higher education? I was like, well, what is that? Like, I thought you have a psych degree. And he's like, well, some of us have psych degrees that work at a university, and some of us have a higher education degree. And it's the study of students, mm-hmm. and how, like, psychologically they grow, and implementing different types of programs for them to learn about leadership and social justice. And so I was like, okay. So I started reading more and more about the industry, that particular niche market. And I was like, okay, great. So where do we go to school? And he's like, well, Columbia Teachers College has a great school, NYU, and he mentioned a third place. So I applied to Columbia and NYU, mm-hmm. with his support and his recommendations. I got accepted to both Columbia and NYU, and I was like so shocked, because I was like, oh my god, mm-hmm. I got into Ivy League school. And I remember getting, my parents were like, oh, you got some letters, they're on the stairs. So I was like, and I opened them, and I ran downstairs. I remember my mom was cooking in the kitchen, and I was like, Mom, I got accepted to Columbia and NYU for a master's degree. And like, she was like, oh, that's nice. Like, and she totally dismissed it. And my dad was like, well, we're not paying for that, you know? And and I was like, all I wanted them to do is be happy, you know? And the next steps for me was to figure out how to pay for them. How to pay for it. But long story short, because Columbia was a one-year program, NYU was mm-hmm. a two-year program, I decided to go with NYU, also because I had half a scholarship for the 2 years. And I went ahead and went to NYU, got my master's in higher education administration, and then I followed it up with a master's in psych. But in that process, my first year of doing my master's degree at NYU, I had a GA ship with the Student Affairs Office.
What ship?
A grad assistantship, okay. A GA ship, mm-hmm. a grad assistantship. Yeah. So I was working in the Student Affairs Office, and I had a woman who was my supervisor. And then her supervisor was Bob Butler, and basically I was assigned around, I don't know, I think 70 or 80 student clubs to mm-hmm. like be their advisor, and then we were also launching a leadership and social justice program where graduate and undergrads could sign up for it and then get a certificate at the end of the program. So I was helping develop these things. Mm-hmm. My supervisor ends up quitting, and Bob, her boss, and the team of individuals, I think there was Myung, I forget the other coordinators, Marcella, who I was working with, were basically, they encouraged me to apply for the position. Typically, you're not allowed to apply for any position at the university if you don't have at least your master's. Mm-hmm. And because I was like, how is this going to be possible? They're like, just interview for it. So I interviewed for it, ended up getting the position. They fast-tracked it up to the, you know, the president. Mm-hmm. They all agreed that I was going to be a good fit. And that really was exciting. But I also was really nervous because I was living in the dormitory on 3rd and 11th Street, and I was a RA. I was a resident assistant to get free housing and a meal plan, because, again, my parents didn't want to pay for school, so I had to kind of finagle and figure things out. So, of course, I used my leadership skills and my knowledge. I landed not just a grad assistantship, but an RA, a resident assistantship, too. So I was doing programming at night, and I was responsible for 3 floors of, like, over, you know, probably 300 students. You know, they would knock on my door late at night. I cut my finger. I had to take me to the hospital. Like, so besides studying, getting a master's degree, and being dyslexic and, like, running, like, working with 70, you know, student clubs and doing all this stuff, I was also doing other work on the side. I didn't really sleep very much. I had to give up that resident assistant. Like, I was becoming a faculty member, basically, at the university.
While studying. Yeah.
And had to give up the RA because I was a student at the time, and I had nowhere to live. So I was like, where am I going to go? And Bob, my boss now, directly my boss, called me in a week after, and he said, I know this might sound strange, but so my boss, Sally Arthur, her boss, Naomi Levine, is a vice president of external affairs at NYU, basically one down from the president at the time, Jay Oliva, and her husband just passed away, and she's looking for a student to live with. She has an extra apartment across the hallway. So I was like, okay, why not? So I go meet Naomi, not really researching or doing my, you know, I'm like, I'll go just meet this older woman who needs a roommate, basically. She had a heart condition and she was nervous, right? So I go meet Naomi Levine and she asked me a couple of questions. She's really short to the point. And she said, I already know a lot about you. Why do you think, you know, you would be a good fit? I was like, well, I'm really kind and
I can cook Thanksgiving.
I was like, and if you need something, I'm here, you know. And so the rule was I needed to be home by 9 p.m. So for the exchange of the apartment across the hallway, which she used as an office, but it was literally a full apartment that the university gave her. And it was at 37 Washington Square West.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I was supposed to be there for 6 months until I got my own apartment. I was supposed to move in with a friend, Nicole, and her family had, you know, apartments in New Jersey, like in Edgewater. Long story short, it didn't work out. And I remember coming home. By this time, Naomi was not talking to me for the first 2 months. I would leave her little love notes on the doorsteps with her New York Times. Mm-hmm. And I would call her every night and say, hey, I'm home. Do you need anything? And she would just like, fine. And I'd hang up. But after 6 months, we became friends. Mm-hmm. We were having breakfast together on the weekends. And we'd go for long walks. And I told her I came home one night crying, and she said, I said, I don't know, like, this apartment thing fell through, I don't know what to do. And she said, well, I'm still looking for somebody, a roommate, and why don't you come move in with me? And I said, okay, but you know that if I'm going to be your roommate, you're not going to boss me around, because she had a reputation, you know, she had a huge office, and she was, you know, quite stern with people. And she said, yeah, yeah, it's fine. So
how old was she?
She was 70, I think I would say 72.
Wow.
Yeah. And yeah, so Naomi, she's so humble when it comes to talking about who she really was. But she was the first woman at, well, first three women to graduate from Columbia Law School. Her friends were Ruth, RBG. And she used to talk about it. Oh yeah, Ruth, she's so quiet, no one really liked her, you know.
Not many people say, yeah, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, yeah, didn't really like her.
Well, because she was like, she didn't understand the appeal. She said she was smart, but she wasn't like dynamic like Naomi. Like, she could really command a room. And so they went to school together, graduated together. They were friends, you know, but it was kind of funny.
Healthy rivalry, let's say.
Right, exactly. It was really funny. But Naomi did a lot of great things in her time. And besides raising $2.5 billion for the university and really taking it out of debt, she's really well known. Besides all the philanthropy for the Jewish community in New York, she's done a lot of incredible things in her lifetime, but she just recently passed away in January, and New York Times did a beautiful article about her. And but 22 years, she became that grandmother, parent figure I've always wanted in my life. We had healthy, you know, arguments, and because I was her plus one to everything, I would, you know, I met Larry Silverstein and went, and, you know, we went on his yacht, you know, when we went to go.
What an extraordinary sort of relationship.
Yeah, we had I mean, people were always so shocked that I was able to, like, break through her barrier. Mm-hmm. Did she not have children? She had a child, Joan, and two grandchildren. But Joan and her were not very close. Mm-hmm. And during the 22 years I knew Naomi, I would encourage her to, like, be better, you know, by calling Joan and having a relationship with her. And I said, listen, if I can build a relationship with my parents, and it wasn't easy, you know, we didn't meet eye to eye, you can too. That's what I used to say to her. And we had different political views. We're obviously different religiously. She was Jewish, I was Muslim, you know, different, huge age group. When I moved in with her, I was 21 years old.
Wow.
When I finished my first master's, I was 21 years old. And so there were so many differences between us. We would have lots of arguments, sometimes ended in a lot of crying and slamming doors. But we loved each other so much. So her passing was really hard on me.
How long did you live with her?
So a total of 15 years, because I ended up going back to live with her when I was doing my degree at Parsons, when I was switching fields, and I had to cut costs. And so she said, oh, you know, my nurse, like, left, so why don't you come live back here? And she was literally like family. She always wanted to support and help me. She really believed in, you know, she saw the fire in me and, like, saw part of me and her. And, you know, just kind of, she always said, look, if I could go from the Bronx to Park Avenue, you can too. Yeah, she was my biggest cheerleader. But I mean, I think a lot of people don't know who she was, but she really did incredible things.
Well, I'll put the article in the show notes. Yeah. Naomi
B. Levine.
B. Levine, right.
Yeah.
You talked about that switch in career focus of going to Parsons. I mean, what was it led you to then make that pivot and say, this is going to be my main predominant focus?
I wanted to continue to push and be more creative. I felt like even though I was doing incredible things at NYU, I was still part of the administrative team at NYU and part during 9/11 and doing all such incredible things at the university, being support team to other faculty, students of color. But I felt like a part of me was missing. I was still not being fully creative the way I wanted to be. And it's funny because when I was doing my undergrad, halfway through, I applied to Parsons and FIT. And I think I was 19 years old, and I got accepted to both schools for interior architecture and design. But I didn't tell my parents. I just applied. And then I was like, do I wait and graduate with a double major and a double minor, or do I switch now? After a lot of thinking, I was like, I don't want to get into an altercation with dad. I don't want it.
Again.
So I said, you know what? Let me wait. And then I didn't think I was going to end up getting accepted to Columbia NYU, so I figured the next route would to apply to reapply to Parsons at FAT, but then I got in, so I said I took the leap of faith, and I wanted to support the idea of being a lawyer, accountant, you know, right? Like, so that was the closest I would ever get to like, you know, getting into that structure in terms of getting into a field. I'm not going to be a lawyer. I wasn't going to be an accountant. I wasn't going to be an engineer. But if I got a master's in higher education administration, I think my parents would be proud. It's a stable.
Check mark, yeah.
Exactly. And I felt a little bit guilty at one point. And so I was like, let me pursue something they would be happy with.
Mm-hmm.
And I was interested in the field. I loved the time. I was in the field for 4 years. And I loved everything I did. And I think a part of that work is represented in the work that I do now. But I felt like a piece of me was missing. So I reapplied to Parsons and FIT, and they were like, looking at my portfolio, they were like, I had a robust portfolio because I had taken a couple of classes at NYU and then another community college of interior design. And like learned about space planning and sketching. I had tons of sketches and drawings. But like, they were like, you have to do like this little exam that with the application, but it was so robust. They're like, you're obviously accepted. Cause I went in for an interview as well. And they're like, well, I have no comments. Everything is great, you know? And I got accepted, and that was really it. And Naomi was like my parents, like, I can't believe you're switching fields. I thought she was going to encourage me. She was just like, why are you going back to school? You're going to pay all this extra money. And it's funny because she was like a supporter, but then she also was worried because she had grown to love me as a daughter, or as a grandchild. And she then also became similar to my parents, where she was like, well, NYU, like, you know, it's safe. Mm-hmm. You know, you have your full 401k and you're this and you're that. And, you know, it's like a little nice package, right? And I was like, Naomi, I know I'm going to do really well in this field. This is where my passion lies. Like, all these things that I've been doing, I love, and I want to continue to do it, but I want to continue to do it through a lens of creativity and through architecture and design. But it wasn't an easy road. You know, it's like there's a lot of math and technical things, skill sets that you have to learn. And being dyslexic, it took me time to get passed through. And at the time, you had to also learn how to draft by hand.
Wow.
I mean,
unlike now.
Unlike now, that's not part of the curriculum. I had an old school teacher, and she was like, "No, you have to redraw this." And like, and it's like I have these old drafting pencils, and I believe like the semester after, I think they cut that class because they were integrating more technology, but I was still like, basically, if you didn't pass that class, you couldn't move on. And of course we learned CAD, you know, all the architectural programs as well. But like, she's like, well, what happens if your computer crashes and then you have to deliver some to a client? You have to know how to draft by hand. I'm glad I know how to do it, because a lot of people don't know. Right. But does it ever happen? No. Never once to have to deliver something to a client on a draft of floor plan by hand.
But
it's good to have the skills.
Who knows? There might be a cyber attack at some point.
No, you know.
You just don't know. You've got that up your sleeve. Okay, we're going to leave part one there. In part two, we dive deep into Sarah's journey, her career, and her future vision. And of course, we cover all the quickfire questions. See you next time. Okay, that's all for this week, folks. If you're enjoying the show, please subscribe, rate, recommend, or review, depending on where you listen. And if you have someone you'd like us to interview, just DM us on Instagram at The Impossible Network, or email us at info@theimpossiblenetwork.com. And please give our other podcast, The Raw Hospitality Show, a listen. They are both Fabrica Collective Productions. See you next time.